Please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Susie from Lancaster.
Hi, I'm Susie. I'm an alcoholic. I always get super nervous when I speak, and I drink a lot of water, so I apologize in advance. I said a prayer in the bathroom, you know, that God would speak through me and that I would be of use to someone here, and that's a miracle for a girl like me, because the only things that I used to pray for were so selfish, foxhole prayers, you know, like, God, please get me out of this one. God, please bail me out. Like, God, please someone send me cigarettes in whatever facility I was in. Those were the only types of prayers that I ever said. So I guess I'll start. I have a sobriety date. It's April 26, 2011. I have a sponsor. She knows she's my sponsor. She hears from me on a nightly basis when I do my 10th step with her. I was taken through the 12 steps of AA out of the big book. I have the honor and privilege of sponsoring other women and doing for them what my sponsor did for me, which is putting their hand in God's hands. And I have two home groups in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, Monday and Thursday night at 8 p.m. at the 521 Club, if any of you are ever out there. I keep saying too. I always do that. So, my job today is to tell you what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. You know, my job is not to tell you what it was like. I think if we're all sitting here, all of us know what it was like. You know, none of us got here on a winning streak. I don't think many people end up in AA repetitively by chance. So I'll just tell you a little bit about my story and hopefully speak from the heart and someone can get something out of it they can relate to. So I was born, so we can all relate to that. There's a good starting point. I had a mother and father, a loving mother and father. I was born in Westchester, Pennsylvania, who gave me, you know, everything that I needed and almost everything that I wanted. And from a very young age, my sponsor, when she first started taking me through the big book, you know, pointed out this spiritual malady that it talks about. And from a very young age, I could relate to that because in a room full of people, I felt completely alone. When anyone was talking, they were definitely talking about me. You know, there's that selfishness and self-centeredness from a very early age before I picked up a drink. They were definitely talking about me, and it was nothing good. And especially with other, like, little girls and women, I would constantly be playing this game in my head. I would be comparing myself to other people. And, you know, I was smarter than you, but not as pretty as you. I had better stuff than you. You know, but I wasn't as popular as you. Like, whatever it was this sick game in my head that no one else was aware of. And because of it, my ego separated me from everyone else and from God. And at the age of six, my life changed drastically. The big book talks about every man, woman, and child being born with this fundamental understanding of God deep down. And then these worldly calamities getting in the way of that. And when I was 6 years old, my father took two medications together that killed him. And up until that point, he took me to church. We were members of a Presbyterian church, and I went to church with him every Sunday. And after that happened, my family life changed a lot, you know what I mean? And it wasn't like I stopped believing in God, and it wasn't even like I hated God. But any type of a higher power or God that was personal to me, that was looking out for me, you know, that relationship disappeared right there. Because in my 6-year-old mind, my 10-year-old mind, my 12-year-old mind, you know, where was he when that happened? And so at a very young age, I started doing, like, whatever I could to take me outside myself and to feel better. And for me, for a long time, that was food, before I touched a drink. At, like, 10 years old, I was, like, 230 pounds. You know, whatever I could do to get me outside of me and feel better, just even for a little bit. And eventually, you know, thank God I found alcohol. Thank God I found a drink, because my mind would not stop running. You know, the game that I played in my head with other kids, you know, part of it was delusional, but when you're a 230-pound, like, 12-year-old kid, like, kids can be mean, you know? So I felt, like, completely separate from everyone else. And like I said, thank God I found a drink. And I started drinking at a young age. I can't remember. I've heard people say from the podium that, like, the first time they took a drink, the first time alcohol crossed their lips, they knew, like, that this was their solution and, like, that they had arrived from that very first drink. And I can't say that I had that experience. I don't even know if I remember truly, like, the first time I tasted alcohol. But I know that I did like it, and I continued to seek it out. My mother sent me away to boarding school for 7th and 8th grade, and when I got back to public school in 9th grade, my drinking really progressed, as it does for everyone. You know, I have a progressive disease. I have this malady that I used to treat with alcohol until that stopped working. So I continued to seek out alcohol, and I knew that, like, you know, being part of the math club and AP classes, like, wasn't making me very many friends. So I sought out the people who were doing, you know, what I like to do, which was drink. And I started getting in trouble. Because, like, an alcoholic like me, like, I cannot conceptualize that consequences are real for me. You know? And that was instilled in me at a very young age. By 10th grade, I was kicked out of my public school. You know, I was asked to leave. I was given the choice between going to Case or to this alternative school, which was 3 hours a day, and you filled out packets and got a cigarette break, you know. And that school, like, obviously I chose that one. And I think that school was, like, designed for kids who were working, you know, who had a job, stuff like that. You know, me, I was just getting loaded and getting in a lot of trouble. You know, and like, very quickly, drinking went, you know, from being a fun experience to being an absolute necessity. You know, it was no longer fun for me. I can say probably from the time I was, like, 16, it was no longer fun for me. And it got to the point for me where I had to take a drink every morning not to be vomiting. You know, I had to drink to function. And the consequences started getting more and more real. These terrible, horrific, traumatic things started happening to me as I got older. You know, and I won't go into details because, like I said, we don't all share the same experiences, but what we might share are the same feelings. You know, and I started to feel like my solution was no longer working. You know, no matter how much I drank, my head didn't shut up. You know, no matter how much I drank, like, I didn't have real friends. No matter how much I drank, the consequences, they wouldn't go away. You know, and before, when drinking would, like, dull them out, it no longer did that for me. When I was 18 years old, I decided I was going to go to Temple University. I relocated to North Philadelphia, which was a bad place for an alcoholic like me to be. And my disease really took off, you know. And it was around that time that the consequences started getting, like, more and more real. You know, ending up in the roundhouse, ending up on probation, DUIs, falling asleep driving, you know, completely falling asleep driving. You know, and I still didn't see that, like, maybe my God did have a purpose for me. You know, waking up after totaling a car, you know, and being fine and being able to walk away. You know, I just brushed it off like maybe I had a bad night. And I think it was around that time that I started showing up in detoxes. Detoxes and rehabs, because I honestly thought, you know, that alcohol was my problem. I thought that if I was not physically addicted to this substance, this alcohol, I thought that if I could wake up without vomiting, without a drink, you know, that I would be okay. So I started showing up at all these detoxes, and like an alcoholic like me, so I'll throw up my hands, I'll beg for help. You know, I'm the type of girl, like, I'll walk into an emergency room and tell them that I'm going to kill myself to get funding to go to treatment. And I'll tell them exactly how I'm going to do it. I'll cause a scene. I'll scream. I'll yell, you know. And then I'll get to detox. And then, like, day five, I'll start feeling a little bit better, you know. And then I'll want to tell them help, like, how they should help me. You know, like, maybe I'm willing to do this, but getting a sponsor, like, going to meetings, I'm sure that if I'm not sick anymore, I'll be okay. You know, I'm sure that if I'm not physically addicted to this alcohol, that I'll be okay. And I really didn't understand, like, I believe that there are, you know, there are levels of sobriety. Like, there's physical sobriety. Like, day five of detox, I was as physically sober as I was going to get. You know, and the spiritual and the mental and the emotional sobriety was a concept completely foreign to me. You know, I thought that if I was physically sober, I would be okay. And it's like, you know, if you're drowning in the ocean and someone throws you a life preserver, you know, you don't throw it back and say, no, I want a red one. But that's what I would do. I would go into these treatment centers and I would, like, beg these people, and I would show up at meetings. you know, and I'd raise my hand, and I'd be like, I'm new, and I have, like, you know, 10 days sober, and I need help, like, please help me. And people would try to help me, but I was unwilling. You know, I was not able to even be honest with myself. I was not open-minded, and I was not willing. In the big book, it talks about, like, seeking this with the desperation of a drowning man, and I don't think I could do that until I was drowning. I don't think I could do that until I was completely out of all of my own ideas. You know, and I remember, like, the last time I was in treatment, I had the same counselor that I had had. You know, I'd been to this particular treatment facility on, like, 3 or 4 other occasions. And I remember getting there, you know, completely broken and desperate, as always. And I remember him saying, you know, like, Suzanne, what is going to be different this time? He was like, what led to your relapse? You know, and I was like, I don't know. You know, those justifications, you know, those excuses I could make, and the big book talks about it. You know, I was out of that. Like, in my heart of hearts, I didn't know why I was doing this. And he asked me, like, Suzanne, what's going to be different this time? And I was like, I don't know. You know, every other time I had a laundry list of things I was going to do. And I was really good at, like, being the model patient. I would be like, I'm going to get a sponsor. I'm going to do a 90 and 90. I'm going to get a home group. I'm going to go to this recovery house in Allentown or in wherever, you know. And I would know which house I wanted to go to, probably because there was a boy that was in that treatment facility that was going to a similar house. So I'd pick, you know, one where he was going. And, like, that was, you know, that last time I was in treatment, I was completely out of my own ideas and plans and designs because they didn't work. You know, and I'd get to treatment. I was so entitled. I would get to treatment or I'd end up in the roundhouse. And, you know, that first phone call I would make, you know, I'd call my mommy. And I'd say, Mom, you know, I know, you know, you might not have heard from me for, like, the past 6 months. You probably, you know, are wondering if I'm dead. Well, I'm not. You know, I'm in treatment, and you're going to need to send me my makeup, my hair straightener, because the most important thing is that I look absolutely my best in early sobriety. That is the most important thing. And then you're going to need to send me a carton of cigarettes, you know, because that's also very important to me. And I'm going to need this all right away. And that's the type of daughter I was. You know, that's the type of human being I was. Everyone in my life served a purpose. Everyone in my life served a purpose. You know, and that is completely opposite of this life that I've been given in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, my only hope is to be of purpose and use to other people around me. And, like, that is a far cry from who I was when I got here. I've heard people say, like, AA gave them their life back. Well, AA gave me a life. Like, I had no life. Absolutely no life whatsoever. So... fast forward, I know I kind of jump around a lot sometimes. So last time I was in treatment, I had gone to treatment in February of 2011. You know, and I was out of friends, out of money, out of options, you know, and that's not my sobriety date. So I go to treatment in February of 2011 for like the 10th, 11th, 12th time, whatever it was. And I get a phone call while I'm in treatment that my mother had had a heart attack, you know, and it's just me and her at this point in our family. So I get this phone call that my mom had this heart attack, and, like, she's in the ICU and all this crap. You know, my counselor was like, you need to stay. Like, you can't leave. Like, you can't leave this treatment facility. You need to stay. And I listened to him, and I stayed. And I decided, you know, I picked the recovery house I was going to. I'm going to go to this house in Allentown. And you know, I went to that house. Week one of being in that house, my mom had a second heart attack while she was in the hospital. And I got that phone call, and, you know, at this point, I probably had, like, 30 days sober. You know, I had no solution, I had no sponsor, and I didn't have a relationship with God in my life. You know, and like, if you would have hooked me up to a lie detector test the day that I left that recovery house, I would have told you that I was going to stay sober, that I was going back home to be a daughter, you know, to help my mother. Like, I was all she had, and she was dying. I would have passed that lie detector test. You know, in my heart of hearts, I was positive that I was going to stay sober. And with no solution, it was about a week until I drank again. And it got really, really bad. It got really, really bad. You know, my mother ended up having to call the police on me. She was released from the hospital bed, round-the-clock nurses caring for her. and her alcoholic daughter, like, terrorizing her life. And that's where my drinking takes me. I don't care if you're dying in a hospital bed. You know, I don't really care what's going on with you. You know, I will do whatever I need to do to get my next drink. That's the type of person I am when I'm drinking. But I'm no longer like that today. So fast forward, she calls the cops on me. And I remember the police officer picking me up off the floor. And I said to him, he said to me, he was like, look at you. Like, look at you're a wreck. He was like, your mother is downstairs in a hospital bed dying. And he said, look at your arms. Is this all you're going to be for the rest of your life? Like, look at you. And I was, like, really torn up at this point. And I told him, I would rather die, you know, than be an alcoholic. I said other words, choice words. But I said the essence of what I said was I'd rather die than be an alcoholic. And he looked at the other cop and he laughed. And, you know, apparently you don't tell the police you want to die because they take it seriously and it was not fun. you know, and I just, that led me to my last time in treatment. I was only able to get a week and a half of funding. You know, they get tired of funding people like me because, you know, I just abused the system. So I got a week and a half in treatment. And at this point, like, there's no mommy answering the phone. I had nowhere to go, and I was out of options, and they sent me to this halfway house in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, called the Gatehouse. You know, and I would love to stand up here and say that, like, you know, I was out of ideas, and I immediately got a sponsor and, like, embraced this program and, you know, had to have this solution, but that would be bullshit. You know, thankfully, at that point in my sobriety, God did for me what I was incapable of even doing for myself. You know, and at that halfway house, in order to get on second phase and get your cell phone, you have to have a sponsor. And God put the right woman in my path, and she immediately started taking me through the steps. And I had gone to a lot of meetings in Chester County. And I would hear things like, you know, this isn't a race. I would hear things like, take your time picking a sponsor. You know, there's no diploma, like, don't rush it. But an alcoholic like me, like, unless I immediately find a solution that works better for me than getting loaded, I'm going to get loaded again. You know, I don't have the luxury of being a dry drunk. I'm incapable of it. I tried it time and time and time again. You know, I would try to just make a 90 and 90 and, like, white knuckle it through my sobriety, and I was not able to do so. I kept ending up loaded, you know. And this woman immediately, like I said, started reading out of the big book with me and taking me through these steps. You know, and she described this illness in a way that I hadn't heard it described before. You know, I had had sponsors before, and I'm sure someone probably presented it to me this way before, but I guess I was just, like, able to hear it that time. And she talked about this spiritual malady in ways that I could relate to, you know, like feeling alone in a room full of people. And she talked about, like, this physical allergy, and she told me that an allergy is simply an abnormal reaction. You know, it doesn't mean that, like, I break out in hives or anything like that. It just means that I react differently from other people. And this physical obsession. So once the alcohol is gone, like, that next day, my mind will obsess over the next time I'm going to be able to drink. It's an obsession so great that no human power can relieve it from me. And she asked me, you know, it was obvious to me when I was getting loaded, you know, that my life was unmanageable. And I knew that I was powerless over alcohol. And that's the really scary part. You know, like, times 10 in treatment, I had worked the first step. You know, I knew I was powerless. I knew my life was unmanageable. But, like, I didn't care. I knew what was going to happen when I drank again, but I was powerless over not drinking because I lack power. You know, it says it in the book, that's my dilemma. And I hadn't found this God-based solution. You know, so she asked me to take a look at the ways my life was unmanageable newly sober. You know, because she pointed out to me, like, every one of my relapses, the only constant every single one of those times was I was sober when I relapsed. Like, that was the only similarity. You know, you put me in Allentown, you put me in Philadelphia, you put me in Westchester, whatever. Every time I relapsed, I was sober when I did it. You know, so she pointed out to me that, like, my disease is in my thinking. You know, my spiritual malady causes me to, like, seek out this solution, you know, and I'll find it. I'll either find it in God or in the other kind of spirits. You know, so she talked about the second step with me, and, like, I didn't necessarily believe that this would work, you know, and thankfully the wording in that step is could, not would. You know, I did not believe that I was going to stay sober. I did not believe that this higher power concept, this God she talked about, was going to keep me sober. But she, like, had all these analogies for me, you know, and one that I love to share is, you know, I was asked, if you flip a light switch on and there's electricity, do you believe the lights are going to go on? And, like, yes, I do, you know. And she asked me, so I'm telling you, she said, do you believe I'm an alcoholic? And I said, yeah, you know, I've talked to you enough. I've heard, you know, she talked drunk to a drunk, you know, so I related to her. So I was like, yes, I believe you're an alcoholic. And she's like, well, I'm telling you that God has kept me sober. So can you explain why the lights turn on when you flip that switch? And I said, absolutely not. You know, she said, but you believe it happens, right? And I was like, yeah. And she was like, so stop trying to understand God. Stop trying to understand why or how this God could keep me sober. You know, and just be open-minded enough to believe that it could happen for you. Because why are you so unique? Like, you don't have to understand it. You don't even have to wholeheartedly believe in it. You just have to be, like, willing to take the action, in my case. You know, I was willing to do whatever she told me to do. And very shortly thereafter, we were on our knees saying this third step prayer. And for me, like, when I first started saying it, and she directed me to say it every morning, you know, and when I first started saying it, I was reading these words out of this book, you know, and these were empty words to a God that I wasn't sure if I had faith in. You know, I believed in God, but the faith wasn't there. But I was willing to take the action, you know, and that faith has grown in spite of myself. And, like, that's the thing with me. Like, you know, I can't often feel my way into acting, you know, but I can act my way into feeling. Like, for me, I just need to do the next right thing. And like, the emotions, the feelings, you know, the spiritual side will follow. And that was the case for me very early on. You know, I was willing to get on my knees and say that prayer, even though I didn't believe it was going to work, and it did. So, she continued taking me through the steps, you know, the fourth and fifth step. And, like, I had this image of myself in my mind, you know, and this was something that I believed to be true about myself, you know, that all these people had wronged me, like, poor me, you know, my dad died, my mom's dying, I don't have any other family, like, poor me, I'm a victim, like, all these people have treated me so badly, you know, and that fourth step really, like, smashed that delusion for me. You know, my ego was separating me from God and from everyone else. And, like, through a fourth and fifth step, I was able to knock that down a little bit. You know, I was able to look at my part in situations that I didn't even, like, realize I had a part in. You know, I would, like, have these expectations of people. And then when they wouldn't live up to them, I would resent them. You know, but I never communicated these expectations to these people. And I didn't understand that that was dishonesty. You know, how can these people live up to these imaginary ideals I have in my own little sick head, you know, that no one else is even aware of, and then when they don't, I condemn them. And then I play the victim because they didn't treat me right. And all of this stuff was pointed out to me, you know, through a thorough fourth and fifth step, you know, and then sixth and seven, and she told me to, like, take this hour and, like, reflect and, like, say this other prayer. And I was willing to say it, like, same type of story. You know, I was very early on in sobriety, and, like, I said this prayer. And I love how in the big book, you know, it outlines, like, you know, these resentments, and then it gives me, like, a practical sick man's prayer to say when I'm resentful. This fear. And then there's this prayer I can say, and, like, the sex conduct. And then there's all these ways for me to take things into meditation and prayer and, like, receive guidance. You know, and it wasn't until I really started reading the Big Book with other women that, like, I had this experience with it where all these other things were jumping out at me and I just got, like, really fired up about it. You know, and then, like, the eighth and ninth step, I sat on that for a really long time. Like, she kept telling me, she was like, "You're just making a list." And I was like, "You're lying. Like, I've seen the steps on the wall. This is not just a list. I'm not that stupid. Like, I might only have, like, a month or two sober, but, like, I've seen the steps. You know, I know what comes next." And she was like, "No, you're just making a list. Like, don't worry." You know, and she explained to me that, like, this list, like, yes, I was going to make right what I did wrong in my ninth step, but, like, the real purpose, you know, was to fit me to be of maximum service, to, like, be able to be where God needs me to be. And like, those promises that we read a lot in Lancaster at the beginning and end of meetings, those ninth-step promises, you know, she told me, like, they're ninth-step promises for a reason. How can I expect to have peace of mind when I've stolen my mother's peace of mind and not given it back to her for years and years and years? You know, how am I to expect, you know, the fear of financial security to leave me? You know, when I was robbing people's houses and I get my tax check and I'm buying, like, Jordans, you know, and tattoos and, like, purses with it. You know, she explained to me that if I want those promises to come true, like, I'll be amazed before I'm halfway through making my amends. And I still do buy purses sometimes. You know, I still do. I think that's why she's laughing, maybe. You know, but, like, that is something that I had to become willing to make. You know, and, like, the 10th step and the 11th step. Okay, so with my first sponsor, like, we read over the 10th and the 11th step very quickly. You know, and she told me, like, I'm going to watch out for, like, fear, resentment, self-seeking, selfish, dishonesty. You know, and when these things crop up, like, she told me what to do about it. And then the 11th step, like, praying and meditating in the morning at night, you know, and trying to get closer to God. And for me, for a really long time, my 10th step consisted of calling my friends when someone I felt offended me. I would call one of my friends in AA, and I would be like, "You will never believe what this girl said to me," or "You will never believe what she did." You know, and I told my new sponsor about what she asked me what I was doing for my 10th step. You know, I told her, you know, when I get angry, I'll call one of my friends and I'll do a 10th step with them really fast. And she was like, "No, honey." She was like, "You're just bitching. Like, that's not doing a 10th step. That's, like, gossiping, you know?" And that was my 10th step. And my 11th step consisted of, like, I would read spiritual quotes on Facebook. And sometimes I would share them, too, if I was feeling, like, extra spiritual. And I still do that because I like spiritual quotes. But, like, that was my whole 11th step. Like, and I would read, you know, I would read pages 86 to 88, sometimes 84 to 88 if I was feeling extra ambitious, you know. But that was my whole 11th step. So pretty much for a long time, like, I was practicing the first step and the 12th step, you know. And I was sponsoring, like, half of Lancaster. And I was doing step work with, like, all of these women, like, around the clock. You know, and the delusion that I could drink like a normal person had been smashed. You know, so I was doing the first step, and I was doing the 12th step, but I was, like, missing out on a whole bunch of stuff. And it's a miracle that I didn't drink, really, I guess, looking back on it. And I really almost did. So a little bit about more about what happened. So at first, like I said, I'm in this halfway house with 20 other women. And I hated women. You know, if you were anything like me, like, I knew what you were capable of. I wanted nothing to do with you. So I hated women. I'm in a halfway house with 20 women. I'm super resentful every day. They tell me to go get a job. I go get a job. I worked at Arby's and Hollister at the same time, both jobs. So I would have to go from, like, Hollister, or I usually had to go from Arby's to Hollister. Like, fries to, like, trying to look cute. And I'll never forget, you know, the one day I was working at Arby's, and I hated that job. I hated that job so much. And a man took a shit on the floor in the bathroom. Excuse my language. In the Park City Mall. He literally, someone went to the bathroom on the floor. And my manager said to me, Suzanne, you know, you're going to clean this up before you leave. And it was like 8 o'clock at night. The mall was closing. It was 9 o'clock, whatever. The mall's closing. And he told me I had to clean it up before I left. And I walked out. And I called my sponsor. And I was like, this man, you know, and he didn't even give me, like, legitimate cleaning gloves. He gave me, like, the little sandwich-making gloves to clean it up with. And I called my sponsor, and I was like, Liz, like, I am not doing this. I was like, I'm getting paid $7.25 an hour, you know, to make curly fries. Like, I am not doing this. I'm not going back in there. And she was like, how's that worked out for you in the past, you know? Every single time you didn't like a situation in your life, like, you ran from it. You know, she had heard my fourth and fifth step. She knew my story. And she told me, Suzanne, you know, if you want something you've never had, you have to do something you've never done. And, like, if you don't like this job, you can absolutely look for another job, but you need to give them 2 weeks' notice. And, like, you know, I've directed you to pray to be of maximum service to your employer before you go in, so I think you need to say that prayer again. And I think you need to smoke a cigarette. And then I think you need to go back in there and, like, apologize to him for walking out and see what you can do to be helpful. And you need to clean it up, you know. And I did. And I lived through it, you know. And I was able to start looking for another job. And God constantly put better opportunities in my path, you know. And I quit that job with 2 weeks' notice, which is something that I'd never done, you know. And like, from then, you know, God has continued to bless me with more and more opportunities. And that's nothing that I deserve. Like, that's grace. Because, like, an alcoholic like me, like, left to my own devices, I was out that door. Like, I was not cleaning that up for $7.25 an hour. And today, like, I'm employable. You know, I have a career. I graduated from college. That's a miracle. You know, that is a miracle for someone like me. And more importantly than that, I can sleep at night, you know, like, all of that shit doesn't matter. I could lose my job tomorrow, you know, my best friend could die tomorrow, but I can go to sleep at night, and I know that I'm never alone, and that was one of my greatest fears, you know, was being alone, fear of abandonment, all that stuff. So, like, I continued to work, blah, blah, blah. I went to a recovery house, you know, and from there I was able to get my own place. And, you know, my mom was still very sick, and she still is. October of last year, she had a bilateral lung transplant, you know. And, like, honestly for me, like, I don't believe that I truly knew that God was all I needed until God was absolutely all I had, you know. And I know that, like, I was by myself in a chapel in that hospital during that surgery, and I prayed, you know. And the big book talks about, like, in the face of the collapse of all of our human resources, you know, and that situation, like, the old me, I would have been flailing around on the ground, you know. I would have been, like, demanding some sort of medication to get through that, you know, and I felt a sense of peace and ease and comfort, you know. And there was this woman talking to me about God. Like, the woman who had been in the room with my mom right before that surgery. And, like, what is that but a sign? You know, what is that but a sign? You know, and, like, I'd like to say that everything goes my way and she was fine, but that's not the case. Her body rejected the organs, you know, and she's still very sick today. She's waiting, hopefully, for another transplant. And I'll say that, like, while she was in that hospital, like, I prayed. I didn't pray, like, God, let my mom be okay. Like, God, like, let this be okay. Like, God, she can't die. Like, God, no, no, no. Like, I prayed for acceptance of God's will. You know, and for me, like, if that will is for her to be with my father, then so be it. You know, if that will is to be here with me for a little longer, so be it. You know, but I know that I have been of service to her. And, like, even today, I hired a nurse for the nights that I can't be there, and I commute from Westchester to Lancaster, so I can take care of her and, like, be a daughter to her, you know. And it's not out of guilt like it was when I left Allentown. Like, that was the only reason I left Allentown. It wasn't, like, to be a daughter to her. It wasn't because she was dying. It was because I felt guilty. That's why I left. you know. And, like, today, it's to be of service, you know, in like, whatever capacity that is. And that truly, truly is, like, a gift. You know, so like I said, when I had around 2 years sober, we had gotten the news that, like, she was in accelerated chronic rejection. And I'll never forget, like, I went up to Philly. She was hospitalized, ICU. She gets hospitalized a lot, so that's, like, a regular occurrence. And I had taken the train up there by myself. And, like, when the doctor sat there and said that to me, I was just crushed, you know, and I was very resentful. You know, things that, like, normal people would say, like, you have a right to be resentful for, you know, for an alcoholic like me, like, holding on to resentment is fatal. You know, it shuts me off, like it says in the book, it shuts me off from the sunlight of the spirit. You know, so I'm resenting my whole family, like my extended family, her sisters, for not being there. I'm resenting, like, everyone for letting me down. I'm resenting these doctors. I'm just, like, a ball of resentment. I'm not doing a 10th step, you know, and I'm talking to people who are co-signing my shit. You know, I'm talking to friends in AA who are like, that's awful that your aunt did that. That's awful that she said that to you, you know. And, like, I just got sicker and sicker, you know, and I'm in this loving and caring relationship with this guy, and, like, you know, suddenly, like, everything he says starts to piss me off. And suddenly, like, all my friends in AA, I hate them all, you know? And, like, suddenly my dog's really annoying. Like, everything is just pissing me off. I'm just completely resentful and angry all the time, you know? And I'm faced with, like, this family life dilemma. And it wasn't long before, like, the thought of a drink crossed my mind, and it hit me really strong, you know. And I was driving home by myself in the car, and I was like, I'm just going to get loaded, you know. The boyfriend's not going to let me get loaded like I want to, so he'll go. My mom will die, so then I can just get loaded like I want to, you know. And then the next thought that crossed my mind was, like, when did it become okay for me to think like this? You know, like, I'm an alcoholic. I am not cured, and I won't stand up here and say that, like, the thought of a drink never crosses my mind today, but that obsession has been lifted. You know, but that thought came really strong, and it scared the shit out of me. You know, and I remember I got back to my house, and I just, like, broke down. And my sponsor at the time, you know, and I, like, word vomited on her. I was like, oh, my God, like, I'm in crisis. I just can't do this anymore. And she was like, look, I have the number of this girl who's been through, like, some similar experiences, and you should probably call her, you know, and you should probably, like, ask her if she can help you. And I did, you know, and I'll never forget, like, the first few times, like, talking to this woman. I had this mental picture in my head of what she was going to be like, because she said, like, all these super spiritual things to me, and, like, we were doing this, like, four-column fear inventory and this new, you know, resentment inventory, this new four-step, and she was just saying all this great shit. And then, like, I met her, and she, like, I expected, like, a middle-aged, old, blonde housewife, you know, and she was not that at all. And, like, it completely smashed the delusion for me that, like, I was the only one this had happened to. You know, people in AA, there's nothing in AA that I could go through that someone else hasn't gone through. Like, absolutely nothing. You know, and we are always here to support each other, and that is a beautiful thing. You know, and I immediately started writing on this new fourth and fifth step, you know, and did another 6 and 7 and 8 and 9 and, like, made amends to people who, like, that aunt, you know, that like, I was so angry at, you know. And to this day, like, I'm able to talk to her now, you know. I'm able to call her and wish her a happy birthday, and I'm able to mean it, you know, and that's a miracle. You know, it's through action that my right feelings follow, you know. And I've heard speakers say that, like, I heard a speaker not too long ago that was like, I haven't done a 10 step in, like, a really, really long time. And I looked at, because I'm emotionally sober, and I looked at my sponsor, and I was like, well, when do I get to stop doing my 10 step? And she was like, no, you're not there yet. You know, but like I have days when I'm not resentful. I have days when I'm not consumed with self. And it's mostly when I turn my attention to like others I could help. You know, and I'm able to do that now, like not in a way that I used to. Like not like, look at me, I have 12 sponsees, you know, look at me, like I'm chairing 8 meetings. You know, I'm able to like genuinely help out of a place of like love and care and concern and to give what was so freely given to me, you know, and try and put women's hands in God's hands. Like that was done for me. And that is such a beautiful gift because, like I said, like AA gave me a life. These 12 steps gave me a life, you know. And life is not always easy. Over the summer, in a 2-month period, 2 girls I sponsored overdosed and died. You know, I just spent the day yesterday at a 3-year-old little boy's birthday party. And his father's in prison and his mother died July 1st, you know, and she was not only a sponsee of mine, she was a dear friend, you know, and she had one of the longest 4 steps I've ever heard, you know. What I have is a daily reprieve from a disease that wants me dead, and it's contingent upon the maintenance of my spiritual condition. And that means for me that, like, you know, just like my disease progresses, like, I have to progressively seek God. I have to progressively, like, continue to grow. Because I believe for me, like, if I'm standing still, I'm going down. It's like an escalator. Like, I have to daily put in effort at this. And, like, I've gotten into, like, meditation. And that's something that even 6 months ago, if you looked at me and said, like, you're going to need to go meditate for 5 minutes. You know, I have ADHD, I have all these, you know, problems, and I don't take medication, and my mind just goes, like, here, there. Even, like, when I'm driving, I'll see a miniature pony, and I'll just, like, you know, like, veer off the road. So you tell me that I have to, like, sit there. I love miniature ponies. I do. I really want one. But if you tell me that I have to sit there and, like, be silent, you know, and meditate for, like, 5 minutes, that's like a death sentence. And when my sponsor first told me to start meditating, she, like, suggested this site and, like, some different meditations, and I was clicking on them, and they were, like, 1.5 hours long. And I was like, oh, my God, like, what does she think that I'm doing here? You know, but then she, like, directed me to shorter ones and guided ones and ones in different ways and, like, different forms of spirituality that have really helped me, like, more than anything else, you know, because I need to be silent and, like, listen for those answers. I can't just, like, run around, like, reckless like I used to, because I suffer spiritual consequences, like, very, very quickly. Even, like, 6 months ago, like I said, you know, I would get, like, an unpleasant feeling or emotion. like, I'd be sad, you know. And taking care of my mom, like, what human being wouldn't be sad? You know, when she tells me, like, I would rather just die than have to be in this house for any longer. Like, that's hard to hear, you know what I mean? And it's hard, you know, to be there to listen and not want to say, oh, you're okay. Just to console her, you know, when that's bullshit, because it's too painful for me to hear. You know, and I would get this feeling of sadness, and then I would immediately be like, this isn't okay, you know, and my mind would start to run. Like, this sadness isn't okay. Like, what am I doing wrong? What am I not doing in my program? What can I do to fix it? You know, and then, like, I'd have these emotions and feelings about this emotion. You know, when really, like, if I could have just sat with it, and, like, let it pass, I would have been fine. You know, but then I turned it into, like, this big ball of stuff that just went on and on. I don't know if anyone can relate to that. Maybe. But, you know, pretty much, like, meditation has really helped me to deal with a lot of those issues. You know, and I believe, like, it's just amazing, the gifts that I've been given because of this program. You know, like, I see God in other people. Like, I hear things that just completely blow me away. You know, and there's so much hope. There's so much hope. You know, when I see a girl's eyes light up, when I'm able to talk to her, when she's able to talk to her family again, like, there is no gift greater than that, than I've ever been given. There is no Michael Kors purse that feels that good. There is no, you know, like, my whole life I spent trying to fill, you know, this God-shaped hole with all these outside things. And it was alcohol for a while, and that stopped working. And then sober without a solution, it was money, it was a job, it was a man, it was a car. You know, it was whatever that I could fill that void with. And those things never lasted. But the solution that I found through these steps has so far. You know, and it's an honor and a privilege to be asked to do anything for AA. You know, and it's a miracle that anyone would even want me to speak for an hour or listen to me for an hour. And I don't think that many people walked out, you know, so that's pretty cool, too. And I think I'm kind of running out of things to say. I know it's like 5 minutes early, but, yeah, that's all I have. Thanks.